Good evening, everyone. I want to start by first thanking the co-chairman and members of the committee for inviting me here and doing me the honor of asking me to participate in this 26th Georgia Convention. It's given me an opportunity to meet a lot of friends of long standing and to meet a lot of new friends in the last 2 days. And I've been thoroughly enjoying myself. When I heard that introduction, I could only think of one thought. He couldn't add anything, but there are a lot of my friends in this room will tell him there are a lot of things they could subtract from that introduction. As I stand here for a moment, let me begin by telling you that right now I'm experiencing three very definite feelings. One, I can't help but feel the power and the love of the God of our understanding who could create this room full of miracles and who finally chose to make me one of the miracles so that I could join with you folks. The other thing that I'm feeling standing here is the love and the warmth of your friendliness that just flows from that room out there, and it's enveloping all of us as we stand up here, and it's very comforting. And the third thing that I'm experiencing is that I have suddenly realized the responsibility that now rests on my shoulders for the next several minutes. Because with me standing here speaking to you, and you sitting out there listening, whether you like it or not, I'm going to affect your life. Now, I may affect your life only in a so-so fashion. I may even affect you negatively. But hopefully I may affect you positively. And so tonight, I'm a very happy, grateful alcoholic from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. My name is Rhodes Mitchell. Hi, folks. As has been said by other speakers, I'm sober tonight by the grace of God, and because I now work this program in my life every day, with the love and help that I get from people like you in whatever AA room I find myself. It's my belief that my sobriety is completely unearned and is undeserved. It was purely a gift from the God of my understanding when I acquired enough humility to ask for it and to accept it. I have no shame, and I make no apology to anyone or any audience for having the disease of alcoholism. I'm no more responsible for having this disease than I would be if I had cancer, heart trouble, diabetes, or something else. But I am responsible for treating that illness now that I know and accept it as a fact in my life. And I'll be forever grateful to the end of my days that this is a treatable disease. It's a disease of the feelings. It affects us physically, it affects us emotionally, and it affects us spiritually. And without help, it's terminal. It took a great number of difficult years for me to get here and stand before you sober tonight. I simply could not and would not admit that alcohol was causing any problem in my life. I came to AA first in November of 1965, and I continued to attend AA meetings on a regular basis from that day to this. But in order to keep the record straight, I want you to understand that my sobriety date is September the 13th, 1976, just 3 years ago. Now, I know that doesn't impress many of you, but let me tell you, after 10 and a half years of continued failure, the fact that I can stand here today with 3 years of happy sobriety under my belt, it impresses me. It impresses me. And even when I came to AA, I came for the wrong reason. I didn't even meet the qualification for coming here. I had no desire to stop drinking. I simply came to AA to build some brownie points with my wife and with my boss and to get them off my back. You see, at that stage in my life, my lying and denial powers were so strong that I could rationalize to myself that being arrested, paying heavy fines, being thrown in jail, being hospitalized, losing my driver's license to drive a car, first for several months and then for a year, and finally being institutionalized, I could tell myself that this was a normal way of living. Obviously it wasn't, and my lifestyle continued to deteriorate as the progression of this disease continued. Now that's what my story is all about. And as I relive my life with you tonight, I'm sure you understand that I'm not speaking for AA. I'm simply speaking to you from my own heart. And I'm going to share with you some convictions that have been forged in me from my experiences. It was almost 68 years ago that I was born into a middle-class family where there was great love between the parents and the children, and between the children themselves. My parents did not use alcohol, their friends didn't use alcohol, nor did any of their kin. I was taken to Sunday school and church every Sunday and the prayer meeting on Wednesday night. I was taught right from wrong. From the age of 6, I was taught to make decisions for myself, but I was always made to be responsible for the results of those decisions. I was taught to set personal goals in my life and to work hard to achieve them. My father's work necessitated a lot of movement, and so I attended many elementary schools and high schools before I finally ended up in Atlanta graduating as an engineer at Georgia Tech in the height of the Depression when I was 19. When I came out of school, there wasn't a single job to be had, and for 4 years, I did anything that I could that would produce a little money or service. I bartered, and I worked, no matter how menial the job. And you see, when I graduated from college, I had no hang-ups. I made friends easily. I felt secure. The fact that there was no jobs didn't bother me. I had a good mind, and I knew it. And I had an overabundance of self-confidence and self-reliance. You see, my character defects of ego, pride, arrogance, and intolerance had been deeply embedded in me from the earliest age of my development on. And by this time in life, by the time I'd reached 20, they were major areas in my makeup. In January 1936, I was called back to work for the Bell System. I'd known all my life that that's where I wanted to work because my father had had a very happy career there. And when I graduated from college, I was actually on leave of absence, having worked for them in the summer. To illustrate these defects, the day that I came back to work for the Bell System and they handed me a toolkit and made me an installer, I got my boss to give me an organization chart of the Great Bell System, and I looked at where I was at that entrance job, and I looked all the way up to the top to where the officers and the directors sat in that organization, and I said, I ought to be able to do that in 20 years. I actually made it in 14 when I was 38 years of age. At that time, I was the youngest director and officer in the Bell System. Before I was 30, I'd engineered and supervised the installation of all of the telephone and private line facilities in the Pentagon Building, which was then occupied by the War Department. And during the war, I was requested by the government to take leave of absence, come to the War Department, and become the Director of Communications, reporting to Secretary Stimson. When I left there, at the end of the war, to return to my own company, they awarded me the highest decoration of the civilian can earn from his country for distinguished service. Now you see, I haven't mentioned alcohol at all, because up to this time, I have not yet begun to drink alcohol. It was during this period, when I was 30 years of age, that I picked up my first drink. And I don't know this day why I picked that drink up, and I don't care. The important thing was that for me, I liked the taste of it. It wasn't the effect. I cared nothing about the effect. But boy, did I like that taste, and I became a daily drinker. Scotch was my favorite of all whiskeys, although I liked them all. Now, I didn't set an objective that night to become an alcoholic. That would have been the furthermost thought that I could have entertained. Even in the very worst of my alcoholic drinking, I never picked up a drink with the intention of getting drunk. To me, drunkenness was an obnoxious, degrading, guilt-ridden sensation and happening that occurred when I drank after the illness had progressed far. I was not a primary alcoholic. and the disease progressed rather slowly with me. The first 10 years of my drinking were very happy, pleasant drinking, and I've examined those years many times. The next 5 years of my drinking, my filter was going bad, and there were many times when I ended up being drunk without intending to be drunk. And a lot of embarrassing things happened, but nothing of any substance, so I promptly dismissed those things from my mind. And then I went into 20 years of alcoholic drinking, and a lot of things happened. Now, I couldn't see this at the time it was happening. It's only now in sober hindsight that I can separate those various stages in the progression of alcohol in my life. My wife had an entirely different opinion of my drinking. And I would listen to it and ignore it. Because for me, you see, there was no possibility that I could accept that alcohol was trouble. Even in the first 10 years of what I now know was alcoholic drinking, I didn't have hangovers. As far as I knew, I never had blackouts. I had no trouble with the police. I had no trouble with the chairman of the board or the board of directors. I enjoyed an excellent reputation outside of my own home. But in my own home, this was not so. And Mildred would constantly harangue me about my drinking. I didn't think it was important. I wasn't drinking about a quart a day. Finally, in about 1958 or 59, she got so distraught one night, she said, "If you don't do something about your drinking, I'm going to do something." And with these inbuilt characteristics of ego, pride, arrogance, and intolerance, I said, "You come in here and sit down, and I'm going to tell you the facts of life." And this is what I did. I said, "Now let's look at the record." I said, "I'm highly respected in my profession. We live in a lovely home in the best part of town. We belong to the right country club. We belong to the right in-town clubs. You're driving a new automobile. You never had to ask me for money in all your life. I've never seen a paycheck since I started working. They're all deposited in a joint bank account. You see the bills and write the checks, and I've never even bothered to check balance." I said, "We got a couple of children, one in college and one a teenager in high school, never giving us any trouble." And I said, "They either have been, or I am now president of everything worthwhile in the city of Richmond and the state of Virginia, the National Tobacco Festival, the Governor's Advisory Council. I said, I'm rector of one of our state universities, and I lectured to graduate schools at the University of Virginia, MIT, and Harvard on occasion. And you're keeping scrapbooks of things I do and say." I said, "I couldn't be an alcoholic. An alcoholic can't function like that." Boy, what a paragon of virtues I was when I delivered that self-eulogy. But you know, the tragic part is that at that point in time in my life, I believed every word of it. And there wasn't a human being on the face of the earth who could have convinced me otherwise. It just didn't seem possible that alcohol could be causing me trouble. Now I look back in sober retrospect to find out how was it possible that I operated as effectively as that. And the answer is that I was surrounded by keepers, or enablers, if you like that word better. I never had to be completely responsible for my own actions. You see, I had no problem with hangovers because I was never in a period of withdrawal. I always had alcohol in me. As far as I knew, I didn't have blackouts because any time I appeared in public, there was always a member of my staff close at hand, and he carefully observed every commitment that I made or anything that I said. And when I walked in my office every morning, there was a memorandum laying on my desk telling me of every commitment that I'd made and every contact that I'd made night for or afternoon for, whenever it was. I couldn't forget. And my secretary would remind me when there was anything I had to take action on. I had no trouble with my boss because I only saw him at board meetings. And on those days, I very carefully showcased my drinking and my behavior. The only other contact would be if I initiated a telephone call to him. I had no trouble with the police because the driver picked me up every morning and he took me everywhere I went throughout the day and evening. And he delivered me at home when I got ready to come. So you see, these keepers were making me look good. And the fact that I was seriously in trouble with alcohol was hidden, and probably more so because I didn't want to understand. About that time, my company promoted me again and elected me an officer and director of four of our Bell System companies, and I had to move my corporate headquarters to Washington, D.C. And when I did, my keepers were removed, and all sorts of things happened. Now let me tell you this, it's a conviction of mine that any alcoholic who has a keeper, even if it's only one, it's going to be very difficult for them to recognize the seriousness of their involvement with alcohol as long as that keeper is available. So if there are any of you out there who have that question in your mind, let me suggest you honestly get rid of every keeper you've got. Accept full responsibility for your own actions for 90 days and then make the decision. When mine were removed in less than 2 years, I don't know how many times I was arrested, how many times I was in automobile accidents. I lost my license many times. I paid heavy fines. I was jailed. I was hospitalized. And finally, in January 1965, I was institutionalized at Silver Hill in New Canaan, Connecticut. Now this is a very great facility where they treated you psychiatrically and psychologically, and in those days they did not use any of the principles of AA, unfortunately. They didn't even mention it. Today Marty Mann happens to sit on their board and they make full use of the principles of recovery outlined in the AA program. But you see, for me this became a game. I was to be there for 3 months and they were going to make me well again. I became a very cooperative patient. I did everything and more that they asked me to do. I did my homework. And when I had discussions with these psychologists or psychiatrists, it soon became apparent the kind of answers that were acceptable to them, and I fed those answers to them, and I withheld anything I thought was none of their business. And they let me out 3 weeks early because I had made such marvelous progress in the area of recovery. I didn't learn anything about alcoholism or about me. I caught a plane from Washington to go home and drink my way back to Washington. Now think about that for a minute. Here I hadn't any alcohol in my body for 2.5 months. So there wasn't any physical compulsion. My body wasn't hollering, come on, you gotta give me some of the medicine, huh? There can't be any of that. I didn't have any alcohol and hadn't any for 2.5 months. So what was the reason? It's that horrible mental obsession to drink with which the untreated alcoholic lives day in and day out. The mental obsession. The report that came back from Silver Hill didn't indict me as an alcoholic. It simply said that I'd been asked never to drink again because I had a schizophrenic type of personality for whom alcohol might become a problem. Well, you see, this caused a big change in my lifestyle. I no longer could be a daily drinker. The thought of stopping drinking didn't occur to me. I just became a hidden periodic. But I built the brownie points up by not taking a single drink for several months. And I built the fences at home and at work. And then I began to do a little controlled drinking. And I was miserable because I knew that Mildred knew I was doing it. And so I solved that problem by deciding to make out-of-town trips and visit some of our properties that way, and I'd conduct business and then I'd go back to the hotel or motel and then I could drink the way I wanted to drink. I was returning from one of those trips one night driving my own car, fortunately, and I was involved in a very serious automobile accident, handcuffed, taken down to state police barracks and booked. And I felt this was going to become public knowledge because I recognized a reporter who knew me very well. And so at that particular time, I decided to build a defense I would go to an AA meeting, not because I wanted to stop drinking. But you see, I wanted to be able to say, yes, I recognize it and I'm doing something about it, if it became necessary for me to say anything. Turned out I didn't have to. He was being booked for the same thing. But I did go to my first AA meeting. And let me digress for a moment and say to you Al-Anons, or non-Al-Anons for that matter, if your loved one is attending AA, or even is attending AA and maybe is going back and experimenting, for goodness sakes, encourage them. Don't discourage them. When I called my wife, who had been beating on me to do something about my drinking, told her I was going to AA, her immediate response from ignorance was, oh no, not those people. You're not that bad. You see, what was being pricked here was her pride. It was going to react on her. And so I wasn't to go to AA, but I did. At the end of the first meeting I attended, the man who became my sponsor said, Rhodes, what do you think of it? I said, I was pleasantly surprised, and I think I'll come back and try this program for a while. Fortunately, he was a man who had been around a long time. And he said, let's get one thing straight right off the bat. He says, you're not going to try this program. It's been proven by hundreds of thousands of recovering happy alcoholics. What's going to happen is this program's going to try you, but keep coming back. I thought that's the corniest remark I ever heard. So I went home and had a couple of drinks and thought about it. But he was right, and I was wrong. And for 10 and a half years, I attended AA regularly, but I never could stay sober for any very long period of time. In fact, I was again on one of these out-of-town trips, and I got into a drinking bout that couldn't be hid from the chairman of the board. So I immediately got back to Washington and went in and requested retirement. I planned to retire when I was 60, but I had to retire 5 years earlier. I knew that the chairman of the board of directors would have to relieve me of my operating responsibilities, and I wasn't about to risk what action they might take. It wasn't that I felt they would terminate me, but I thought I'd end up in some shoved aside job somewhere, and I couldn't stand it with my ego, and so I requested retirement. It took me a long time to admit alcohol was why I had to retire, but it was. That's why I had to retire. In March of 1967, Mildred and I moved to Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, and we started going to AA over in Savannah because there wasn't any AA on the island. We'd only been there about 6 weeks when two men showed up at the house one day. One of them was Harry B. from Charlotte, North Carolina, whom many of you know. The other one was the late Jim O'Brien from Savannah, who a great many of you know. And they told me that they had had a conversation that my name had been recommended to them by Tommy L., who's in the room tonight and he'll be your speaker Sunday, saying that I'd moved to Hilton Head Island, and so they wanted me to start a group. Being the only one at that time, to their knowledge, who was an alcoholic. And I said, you've lost your minds. I hadn't been driving about 6 weeks. And they said, that doesn't make any difference. You're going to do it. And so under their goading, their persuasion, and their help, I did exactly that. I started a group at Hilton Head Island, and that first meeting was May the 5th, 1967. And I'm happy to tell you that AA has grown and prospered at Hilton Head in spite of Rhodes Mitchell. We have 3 groups over there, 5 meetings a week in Al-Anon, and we only have 8,000 people on the island. So it has continued to grow, and I continue to go to AA. In February of 1968, I went over and spent a month with Dr. John and Dot, back when they were treating the patients in their home at Lee Street before William Way Hospital was built. In 1971, I went out to Cumberland Heights in Nashville and spent a month out there. In both cases, I got a great deal of love, I got good food, and I got a very deep insight into the principles of AA. But the trouble was, it wouldn't open up this closed mind of mine. And each time I came home from those 2 experiences, I thought everything was going to be fine. And I'd read the big book, and a 12 by 12, and I'd go to meetings. And I'd build up periods of sobriety. Once I even got 11 months, and then there were sixes and threes and so forth, but as time went on, it was only about 30 days between one time of going back to drinking and the next time. In the early part of September 1976, I finally said to myself, now look, you've given this thing a fair shake. You've wrestled with it for 10 and a half years and it isn't working, so why don't you get happy and go back to drinking? And I knew I couldn't do that, be a member of AA and have guilt feelings, so I resigned from AA so that I wouldn't have the guilt feelings. And I bought a couple of gallons of 100 proof vodka. I never could see fooling around with lower proofs when you had 100. I took 2 gallons of vodka home, sat down in my easy chair, and put about 6 ounces over a cube of ice. And I was going to have that one drink and go out and cut them off. That isn't the way it worked. For the next week, that chair, that room, and the adjoining bathroom were my prison. And I couldn't leave that prison any way in the world. I was an absolute physical wreck. My car was in the garage and I had the keys in my pocket. My wife left the second morning because she said I was becoming verbally abusive and she was going to make me completely responsible for myself. She wasn't going to be my keeper. Just before she left, she said to me, here are 2 books that I would like you to read. Think about that for a minute. Here I am, drunker than a monkey, and she says she wants me to read 2 books. Seemed like a strange request, wouldn't it? But you see, the God of her understanding knew what he was doing, and he told her, you get that man to read these 2 books. And in that week, when I was not passed out, I read those 2 books not once, but I read each of them several times, and in those 2 books, lo and behold, I found the key that began to unlock this closed mind of mine. Never again would I be able to exhibit contempt without investigation. And you see what was happening? I had been searching for God for about 3 months before that diligently. I talked to clergymen, I talked to a priest, I talked to Christian laymen, and because either I was not articulate enough in what I was trying to ask for, I know I wasn't getting answers that were any help to me. All I was getting was a lot of theology, or I was getting the mundane advice to keep coming to church and everything's going to be all right. I was going to church every Sunday and everything wasn't all right. I was hurting and things weren't all right. And this led to my belief, get rid of all this and go back to drinking. But during this week, the good Lord let me drink myself into an absolute physical wreck. But he kept my mind as clear as a mountain stream. I remember every single thing that occurred during that week. Mildred would call me every day. And by the way, in case any of you are interested in those books, one of those books was God is for the Alcoholic by Jerry Dunn, and the other is What is God Like by Eugenia Price. Mildred knew by Sunday when she talked to me that I was at my bottom, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and she said she was coming over. And she came over accompanied by our doctor, and they gave me a choice. No longer was I going to be permitted to stay in that house by myself. And again, I'm thankful to them that they gave me the choice. And so I chose to go to Fellowship Hall in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I spent 28 days up there with a new attitude now. And I spent it in deep study and introspection of my life, and thus began my new life of hope and freedom. When I came back, I went back into AA on the island, and this time I came into the group as a newcomer. Every other time when I come back, I always wanted to come back where I was when I walked out the door. I always wanted to have that proprietary interest because I was the guy who had started the group. But this time I didn't. I came back as a newcomer. I no longer talked about how long I'd been around AA. I began to talk about my last drunk. I retired my copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and bought a new one. because my old copy was underlined throughout, and I had a tendency to read the underlinings. And so I got a new copy, which forced me to read all the words. And when I began to read all the words, I began to find out all things I'd missed as I went through it. And I want to share with you a walk through this road of recovery for me. When I opened up that book this time, I started on the inside flyleaf and then to the preface. And the first thing I read in the preface was, it says, this book is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. With my background and training, that simply immediately said, this is a book that must be studied. You won't get anything out of it. Well, you'll get something, but you won't get the maximum out of it simply reading it. You must study it. And another statement in there caught my eye. It says, the principles of recovery do not reveal themselves voluntarily. They must be searched out. Another one further along in the chapter of the agnostic, it said that this book is designed so that I could find the God of my understanding, and that meant they were going to talk about God. And then I began to understand what those three pertinent principles in the fifth chapter were really all about. I am an alcoholic. My life is unmanageable. There's no human power that can relieve me of alcoholism. But God can and will relieve me if I seek Him out. And when I became convinced of that, I moved quickly on and I thought, what else is there new that I haven't found out? The next thing that I found out, and many people disagree with me and feel free to do so, but I found out that this great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, as great as it is, and the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous are not one and the same thing. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is where we find the recovery program, and that's why we come to meetings. Because then we can share our experiences and how we work the recovery program. And it's nice to empty coffee cups and set up chairs and do all these other things. And it's great therapy in the early days. In fact, great therapy at any time when you're working the recovery program. But attending meetings and doing these things of and by themselves as participation of the fellowship will never get you sober, and it won't keep you sober. It's my firm belief that nobody ever gets sober permanently and stays sober until they start working the program of recovery, and the book says that's the 12 steps of AA. 200 words in length that set forth spiritual principles which have applied to my life would enable me to get rid of that horrible obsession to drink and make me happily and usefully whole again. And I was convinced that this was right, and I was all ready then to tear into the steps. And what happened, the big book brought me up short again. It says, you're not ready for that yet. And why wasn't I ready? I didn't understand, and as I read further, I found that word how in that chapter 5, how it works, is defined back on page 570 in the big book. The H stands for honesty, the O stands for open-mindedness, and W stands for willingness. And the book said if I didn't have those three prerequisites, I could never get sober, nor could I stay sober. But they were fundamentals, they were prerequisites. And when I thought I could do something about that, I found there were some other requirements that I had to meet. Chapter 5 told me that I had to want to be sober. I had to want sobriety, and I had to want it bad enough to go to any lengths to get it, and that I'd have to get rid of all my old ideas, and that I couldn't indulge any measures. You see what this program is saying to me? It says, Rhodes, if you want to get sober, you're going to have to commit yourself to this program of recovery. You cannot simply become involved. You've got to commit yourself. And there's a big difference between commitment and involvement. It's like a ham and egg breakfast. Now you see, the chicken that provided the egg for that breakfast is only involved. That's simply a day's work as far as that hen's concerned. She's involved, but that poor pig that furnished the ham, his life was committed. That's what he gave for it. And you see, there is a tremendous difference. And so I decided that I would commit myself to a study, an application of the program of recovery to my life. And for the first time, I was able to take the first step. Oh, I'd admitted many times before though that I was an alcoholic. My life was manageable. That's all the book required. So I admitted I was an alcoholic. But as I read the 12 and 12, it said that I had to accept this disease and all its devastating weaknesses. I had to surrender. And I realized that when they wrote the big book, and they used that word, admitted, it was based on the experience of the first 100 recovering alcoholics, but 50 of them went back and got drunk again. When they got around to writing the 12 and 12, though, that wasn't until 13 years later, and they had the experience of thousands of recovering alcoholics upon which to draw. And they knew by then that unless a person surrendered and accepted the disease as a fact in their life, they wouldn't treat it. And if they didn't treat it, they'd end up institutionalized or they'd die. And so I accepted it as a fact of my life. And as I worked that step, I could see immediately that that step was directed at the physical aspects of the disease. I came to step two, and this step had always been an enigma to me. I believed in God all my life, and yet I wasn't staying sober. And this had caused me some difficulty. So as I studied that step, at least for me, I found a startling thought. This step doesn't even ask me anything about believing in a power. The step starts from the premise that power already exists. That's a fact. All I was being asked was, could I believe that I could tap that power and that that power could restore me to sanity? And you see, here before, this is what my daughter one time tried to tell me when I was talking with her about this. She said, Daddy, you better quit believing in God. And I said, that's a strange thing coming from you. She says, no, it's not. She said, you believe in God like you believe in motherhood, the American flag, and patriotism. She said, what you better do is start believing God. There's a big difference. And you see, this is what the step is saying. Not to believe in, believe that. Believe that. In other words, I was being asked to bet my life that this power could be tapped and it could restore me to sanity. And fortunately for me, about that time, I read an article that said becoming a believer is very much like becoming a swimmer. Intellectual investigation can only take you so far. And then I would have to get into the water. If I wanted to become a swimmer, I had to get into the water and I had to flail my arms and my legs. And only then would I find that my body was buoyant and I'd stay above water. And becoming a believer was very much like the step. I had to accept the fact that I had to take a step toward God based purely on faith. For only in that way would I discover whether or not my faith was misplaced. And I took that step, and my faith was as small as a proverbial mustard seed. But that faith has grown day by day so that it's been strong enough to handle anything that I have met in the 3 years. And it grows stronger day by day. And you see, the beauty of this step was it was addressing the second part of the disease, the emotional side of the disease. And I came to that third step that I'd wrestled with many times before, always unsuccessfully. I never could quite understand how I was to turn my life and will over to the care of God. I also used to think, well, if God gave me will in the first place, what he wants it back for? But as I studied this step, I found I wasn't being asked to turn my will back. I was simply asked to turn it over to his care. And the step wasn't asking me to turn it over. All the step was asking me was to make a decision that that was an objective of my life, that I would get my will and life turned over to the care of God. There was no way in that third step I could turn my life and will over to the care of God. I didn't know what my life and will was. It couldn't be turned over at that point in time. All I had to do was to make a decision, and I made that decision, a commitment. And I did it out front with a trusted advisor, as the book recommended that I do it. I didn't make it in the darkness of a closet or just lock it up in my brain. I did it out front, just as the big book suggested I do it. And I looked at that phrase that said, when we do this, we are reborn. For a long time, I thought that meant, boy, I'm something different now. I found out all that phrase meant was that I was standing on the threshold through which I could step and walk from temporary dryness into permanent sobriety. This was the beginning of a new life if I chose to accept the new life. And so having made that decision, which, as you can see, tackles the third part of this disease. This is addressed to the spiritual side. So the first three steps, which are the bedrock on which everything else in the program of recovery is based. First, the physical aspect, the emotional aspect, and the spiritual aspect. And so then I moved into the fourth step, because I realized now that the way I would turn my life and move under the care of God, it was going to become done through a process of evolution as I worked the remaining steps in this recovery program. It would be done little by little by little. With my past record, I was advised to be very careful and thorough in this four-step inventory. And I did mine a way that I'm not suggesting any of you do at all. But I sat down and I wrote an autobiography of my life in longhand, in narrative form. And I did it in 10-year spans from my earliest remembrance until 10, 11 to 20. 21 to 30 and so forth. And having to cover 60, 40 years, you can see that it was really a volume when I got through. And it took a great deal of time to do it. But for me, and I say I'm not suggesting this for anyone else, for me it was a godsend. Because it relieved me of having to decide what were assets and what were defects. When I got through and I read that over again, the defects of my character jumped out like they'd been written in luminous ink. The assets showed up very clearly too. And the things that I choose to call shortcomings, which are talents which I had but which I wasn't using, were also apparent. And in addition to that, there were the names of all the people that I'd harmed throughout my life. So when I got to step 8, I wouldn't have to make that list, I already had it. Now I know a lot of people don't think it's necessary to make a written inventory. And they're entitled to their opinion, that's fine. But I hold to the opinion that until you make that thorough written inventory, I doubt seriously if you have ever worked the first three steps as they were meant to be worked. I think you've relied on the fact that you've turned your life over in step 3, which, as I just said, can't be done. And you tend to get a little more easy in your recovery program, and your life is like a yo-yo. You're up one day and down another, and you're fussing because you can't understand why. And I think the answer is why is because you haven't taken the time to go in and find out what it was that caused us to drink. This is what the book said. For me, it was necessary. I had to know why I drank. What were these misguided instincts that caused me to drink? I didn't get done because I drank. I drank because I had them. And until I isolated them and began to do something about it, there was no chance of me getting sober and staying sober. And having finished that, I went to the fifth step, and I spent 4 hours with a very trusted counselor. Happened to be a professional man, but he's also a member of this fellowship. And I illuminated every nook and cranny of my life and told him things I swore him down and nobody would know about me. And as I continued to talk, the feeling of relief mounted and the tension departed. And when I walked out of there, I felt like the cares of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. And I sat down again and reviewed those five steps as the book suggested that I did, because it said that I was building an archway through which I would continue to walk to permanent sobriety, where the stones in that archway sound. Again, I've heard it said, you don't have to do that. All you have to do is tell a little bit at this meeting, a little bit at that meeting, a little bit at some other meeting, and you get rid of it. In my opinion, I think this is not only erroneous, I think it's absolutely dangerous thinking. I've seen too many people who've been around AA for a great many years go back to drinking because they tried to shortcut those two steps. And whether we like it or not in this room tonight, some of us are going to go back to drinking, and some of us are going to die an alcoholic death. That's what the statistics indicate with a group this size. So I simply suggest to you that if a thorough written inventory of the fourth step and a thorough, honest admission to God, yourself, and another human being will ensure you being one of the winners and not one of the losers, isn't it worthwhile taking the time to do it? I went from there into the sixth step, and I thought, this one can't be any problem, it's so short. And the first sentence I read in the 12 by 12 says, this is where we separate the men from the boys. And I found out very quickly what it meant. It said I had to become entirely ready to get rid of all my defects. And this took me a little time to do this. Now, even though I was committed, I had to think about that one. You see, I enjoyed feeling superior to some people. I enjoyed participating in a little gospel around the AA room. The only thing is, I called it helping other people. You see, I could hide my greed by calling it ambition. I sometimes indulged in overeating, and they called this gluttony. I used profanity. I cheated on the income tax. I told white lies to get myself out of things I didn't want to get into, and here I am being told all of these things have got to go. That's the price I had to pay if I wanted to continue this walk toward permanent sobriety. And for me, it took 2 or 3 months before I could emotionally get myself ready to pay that price. And then when I did, as the step 7 suggests, I humbly asked God to remove my shortcomings. And then I sat back and waited for my halo. Nothing happened. A couple of months went by, and the only thing that I could tell had happened was that I'm more acutely aware that I've got all these defects of character. Not a one of them has been removed. Not a one of them. And I said, what's the matter? What's the matter? Didn't I let go and let God? The answer is no, I didn't let go and let God. I tried to dump him in his lap. And that isn't what is meant by let go and let God. I suddenly realized that isn't the way God dealt with people. That isn't the way he dealt with me. That isn't the way he's going to deal with my character defects. Well, he was going to, just like this morning, I got up, I got bathed, shaved, and dressed, and I came down here and had breakfast. I got here tonight for this meeting. God didn't do those things. God gave me the wisdom and the power to do them for myself. And this is the way I found he was going to deal with my character defects. When I was ready to deal with a character defect, and I said, God, I'm ready to work on my profanity. Give me the strength and the courage to not use profanity. I began to eliminate profanity from my conversation. And so I have begun over 3 years of working on defects one at a time. And I'm not going to tell you they're all gone, because they're not. And I probably will never get rid of them the rest of my life. But as long as I continue working on them, I know that they're going to keep on being minimal in my life and be less troublesome in my life. But I must continually ask for the power and strength to get rid of those defects. But I've got to do the legwork. I moved in to 8, and as I said, I already had the list, so that was no problem, and I moved on to 9. I took a look at those people to whom I had to make amends, and I looked very carefully to see which ones I couldn't make because it was injury of them or others. And I found out I had to be scrupulously honest to not throw a lot of them under that loophole, you see, and say, well, I better not do that, it might hurt. I think I was honest before I got through, and there were a few that I knew I couldn't make. So I simply sat down and had a conversation with God and explained why I thought I couldn't make these amends, and I asked his forgiveness, and he forgave me, and I forgave myself. And then I went out and I made the rest of those amends. This time I didn't go making apologies. I had the first time. In many cases I was coming back for the second time. This time I told them why I was there. I told them how I thought I'd hurt them. I told them that I was sorry for the harm I'd done, that I wanted their forgiveness and that I loved them. and the reaction range from pure joy to some antagonism. But you see, whatever the reaction was, I was free because I had made the amends. And the ones who want to remain antagonistic, that's their problem, not mine. And when I completed those amends, I read the rest of the chapter, and this is what Tom read to you this afternoon. The promises on page, bottom of page 83 and the beginning of page 84. And it said, all of these things would have come true if I had been painstaking my effort up to this time, by the time I completed working the 9 steps. And I checked, and they had come true. They had come true. I have a new freedom, thought, and action. I'm no longer feeling useless, frustrated. I'm no longer the center of the universe. I know the meaning of the word serenity. I'm at peace with God and peace with my fellow man. I have a genuine interest in other people. I no longer have economic fear or fear of other people. I don't regret one day of the past. And I don't want to close the door on it either, because my experiences are very helpful to other people. Some people say those aren't promises, but I submit to you the language of the book. It says, extraordinary promises we think not. These things come to some sooner than they come to others, but they come to all who are willing to work for them. Now, if that isn't a promise, I don't know what a promise is. And in my case, they came true. And I moved into what I like to think of as 10, 11, 12, as the maintenance steps. And I tried working that. Some people call it a spot inventory and so forth. I tried doing it early in the morning. I tried doing it at night. If I did it in the morning, I couldn't remember the day before sometimes. If I did it at night sometimes, I fell asleep. And finally, that word continued struck home to me, because the word continued doesn't indicate you start and stop. It indicates you're continually doing it. And the thought occurred to me, why don't you use the principle of the replay camera that TV makes such great use of? And so I began disciplining myself to do that. So that today, every time I have an interpersonal reaction, or every time I make a decision, I immediately replay it through my brain right then and there. And if I'm wrong, I admit the wrong right then and there. If the decision is bum, I modify it or change it. I don't want any more trash building up in my life. And this way I can deal with it at the moment, and I don't have to worry about trying to get to Charlie tomorrow to correct something. If I was wrong, I'd tell Charlie right now I'm wrong. I'm not perfect in this area, but I'm a lot better than I was. And for me, this is the easiest way I've ever had to continue to take personal inventory. The 11th step continued, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. This is one of the things I do the first thing when I get up every morning. I have a time all by myself. And I take the first 3 steps of this program every morning in my life. I start with 1, 2, and 3 and go to 11. And I have a conversation with God, is what my praying amounts to. I have a conversation with Him and I talk out loud to Him. And then I keep my mouth shut long enough for Him to reply, like it would be with anyone else. I also ask God for me every morning to remove the desire to drink for that day. And when I go to bed at night, I thank Him. I'm one of those people who do not believe that God has removed my desire to drink permanently. I think the only thing God does for me is to give me a 24-hour reprieve, and that reprieve is based on the quality of my sobriety, or my spirituality, if you'd rather use that word. And so I seek for that guidance every day, and I moved into the 12th step. And that says, having had a spiritual awakening, how did I get it? By working the first 11 steps of this program. That's how you get it. And as defined by Bill Wilson back in the appendices, I have had that spiritual awakening. And notice I didn't say I've been spiritually awakened. I've had the spiritual awakening, and that's an ongoing process, and it's continuing am growing and building day by day by day. And I try to carry this message to other alcoholics. And I try to do this in many ways, on a one-to-one basis, in 12-step work, in outside speaking, speaking in little groups in AA, in discussion meetings, wherever I'm called, I try to carry the message. But the message that I'm trying to carry is not just how do you stop drinking. The message I carry is the complete, profound change, the 180-degree turn that has taken place in my life, because the principles of these steps accomplish what they say they will accomplish. That's the message I carry. And then I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And for a long time, I had a little trouble there because I couldn't find those principles written down anywhere, either in the 12 by 12 or the big book. And suddenly it became apparent to me that they're by inference so strongly that it wouldn't be any problem to write them down. And so I put those principles down on a piece of paper, simply to aid me. And I want to share them with you. And these are simply my viewpoints of the principles of the 12 steps. I think the principle of that first step is honest acceptance. And I think the principle of the second step is faith. And the principle of the third step is trust. The principle of the fourth step is courage. The principle of the fifth step is integrity. The principle of the sixth step is willingness. The principle of the seventh step is humility. The principle of the eighth step is brotherly love. And the principle of the ninth step is justice. The principle of the tenth step is perseverance. And the principle of the 11th step is spiritual awareness. And the principle of the 12th step is service. Let me tell you that life to me is a wonderful adventure today. When I get up in the morning, I look forward to see what's going to happen during the day. By that I don't mean that I don't make plans, I do. But I don't try to live in those plans until the time comes, and I've been successful to some degree in disciplining myself to live right now and not 24 hours at a time. I try to live in the time span in which I'm living. There's nothing I can do about what happened 10 minutes ago, and I don't know what's going to happen half an hour from now, but I'm living right now and I'm aware of where I am right now. And this is where I try to live. And it's the greatest adventure. I just can't possibly think of living life that could be more complete and happy than it is now. And it came to me purely by a gift. And I got enough humility to ask for it and accept it. And I want to close tonight by leaving with you one thought, which to me I use as a prayer every day. And it's simply this. Dear God in heaven, please don't ever let me settle for good enough. And stop reaching out for the best that's in this program. Because surely the best is yet ahead. Thank you so much for your kindness and attention.